Well, hi and welcome. I hope you're all doing great. I hope you enjoyed your week off last week, courtesy of me. I was doing a national presentation with John Assaraf. So we're back, and we're going to talk in this seminar about how to change mind, brain, and behavior and make changes last. I want to tell you how much I appreciate the feedback and the questions that each of you have sent about what you'd like to ask, what you most would like to walk away with. It's been very helpful. There are a couple I want to address. A number I've incorporated into what I'm going to be talking about in the next three seminars, but there are a couple I want to just isolate and address because it's not going to actually be covered in another way. Could I get a management of the background noise when you are when you're shuffling papers, that's kind of picked up. So unless you're ready to talk, why don't you mute if there's going to be any movement. So questions, comments, thoughts, any reflections on the first seminar we did or any other reflections on those two questions about what you'd like to most ask or what you'd like to walk away with or just anybody want to check in?
This is Kip.
Hey, Kip, welcome. Thank you. What's
hey,
going on,
thanks.
Man?
Well, I had a good experience with a fellow that was looking to change a relationship story, and he was under the impression that once we made a decision to internalize a new story and change the behavior, that he wouldn't have the grief and the obsession for, say, the toxic relationship would just end. So it was just real helpful to be able to say you need to be able to grieve the story and to expect that that will be there. He seemed just really appreciative of just saying that. And so it was helpful to be able to articulate that for somebody when they're in that place of vulnerability to give them permission to have the grief and also to challenge the expectation that, you know, the old story would just somehow evaporate. He wouldn't have the cravings or the, that's not the right word, the push for the old way or the obsession.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that's so important that you highlighted that because as we discussed last time, whenever we have a belief or an assumption or, in his case, an attachment pattern, a behavior pattern having to do with a relationship with someone else, that's an anatomical reality in his brain. And it's not something you can just present a better way of doing it and assume it's going to overwrite what's already there. Things just don't work that way, or information would be enough, as we've talked about. And I think handling it in that way sets up the possibility of looking at change and transformation as a process. It's kind of a hard work miracle. It's something that can be effected, that we can co-create and collaborate with someone to do it, and it's an inside job, and it's exactly what we do and what we specialize in as mentor coaches. So great point, and a sense of hopefulness for him.
Yeah,
so thanks,
exactly.
Bill. That's great.
Yeah. I had a technical question for the group. Did anybody else have trouble hearing Dave on the replay? I could hear one of the women who had talked pretty well, but I had trouble hearing your part, Dave. So anyway, I didn't know if that was just my computer.
Let me get Bill. Are you hearing me okay now?
Yeah, I heard you okay.
Okay, I'll get Bill to check that out because everything should be pristine in terms of hearing everything, and you definitely – you definitely should hear me okay. Let me get Bill to check that out. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Thank you.
Because I know a whole number of people are doing this on the replay, so I want to be sure that that's good reception. Well, thanks. Any other thoughts, questions, responses? Well, I wanted to respond to a question that Joanna raised. She mentioned that some life-changing transitions can be very intense, very heavy, or sad. How can we make sure we're not crossing the coaching instead of therapy line here? I think that's a really good question, And I don't think by dealing with intense feelings and issues and things of great moment that you have anything to worry about. It's the framework that we use that defines coaching, because in coaching we're focused on the choice architecture of the present moment, of looking at creating the best and most informed choice now and next. So we're not doing what therapy does, to go back into the old story, to rework the old story, create a better ending, and come to a resolution and an end of the past. Because from our perspective right now, coming to the end of the past does not create a success map for the future. And going back into an old story, even if it's ostensibly to write a better ending, it grooves that pathway even further in someone's brain. So 1,000 better endings later, you've recreated the same process again and again and grooved it even further. So what we're doing is looking at helping someone choose now and incorporate all of the aspects of themselves, all of the ABCs, the affect, the feeling, the behavior, the cognition, the thoughts, and the sensation, the whole mind-body-spirit elements of making the best and most informed decision possible. So as a kind of a example and anecdote, I've been doing mentor coaching exclusively now. As you know, I made a transition after 25 years of practice wholesale to do mentor coaching. And after doing that for a dozen years, there are three, maybe four people I have referred to a psychiatrist. Two of those were people where the story had taken over the author, where they were not able to engage with me in coaching because of another process that needed attention in another domain. And both of those were addictive processes. I could see something like depression being another process that may need addressing with a consultation with a professional. The third instance was someone who needed some help in regulating a fairly significant attention deficit disorder. So it was a hardware issue and needed some help just in getting some medication for that. Now, I've worked with a number of professionals, a number of coaches who have ADD, and usually we're able to figure out things, strategies about how to really regulate and manage and structure things so that that's not necessary, but occasionally it's necessary. So I don't think you have to worry about lopping over into therapy, because you're dealing with the whole person here and now and their decisions and choices going forward, and feelings are going to be a part of that. That's not all of it, but it's certainly a part of that, because we want to balance mind and brain, left and right brain, the emotional and the thinking brain. So hopefully that's helpful. The other question I just want to deal with briefly. How can we be better prepared to see, this is from Amy, how can we be better prepared to see at the earliest stage possible that a transition is coming for ourselves and others? Now, some things you can't predict. When a change happens, something happens externally, then you have to deal with it, then you have to get ready after it happens. But certain things you can see coming, and even though someone may minimize it, it's still significant to deal with. For example, a buddy of mine and I do a weekend retreat. We alternate doing it at his ranch and my ranch. For executives, CEOs primarily, who are within a year of retirement. Now, they know in some part of their soul that they're not going to be happy. They've been looking for it for a long time. They're not going to be happy playing golf every day. That'll last a couple of months. So they recognize in some way that they will need to be prepared for the transition to a new career or a new purpose or some new contribution that they make, even if it's for charity boards or whatever, but that transition is going to be huge. So there are certain things that are predictable about that, that they can be ready for before it happens, because there's going to be enough to deal with as it happens. And some things, no matter how much you get ready for, they're still going to have a huge impact, like the death of a parent. Even when you have 2 years of working on it, you know it's going to happen. It's still real, and that makes it different. So there are certain things that we can predict and look at and know from our experience that dealing with and having plans and strategies are going to be helpful. It's not going to be all, but it will be helpful. So any thoughts or comments about either of those two responses that I just gave to the questions? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode then and move into our discussion. Okay, we're going to talk about how to change mind, brain, and behavior and make changes that last. So first, why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will they repeat behavior that doesn't work, sometimes do it harder, and expect a different result, even if it leads to, say, lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. And that sometimes creates the illusion of effectiveness. Repetition can represent itself as effectiveness. Now, a new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, to the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that is synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a very brief exercise. If you can free both hands, put your phone, if you don't have a headset, tuck it between your shoulder and your chin. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers very firmly. Now, notice how this feels. Notice also which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but switch so that the other thumb is on top. Now, how does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, move your thumbs back to the original place. Sort of a relief, feels right. That's why people don't change, or succeed remarkably, or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, if you up the ante and add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. Now, we're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. But remember, there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the second part of that, the answer to why change is difficult, is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns, and he noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was really well worn, despite it really being sort of circuitous. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. No matter how many twists and turns, and he got increasingly diabolical with this, each person followed the path of least resistance. No one started a fresh path. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. Now, to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. stimulation for new insight, a circumstance where the brain can't predict what happens next. A catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, a new information, a new context, a powerful question by a mentor coach. Now, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior, because that's what exactly we do as mentor coaches. The uncertainty of this newness can read as evidence not to proceed, as intuition of a wrong choice, or as a signpost of change and progress. We help guide and help interpret and reframe that. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new, something that's a pattern, that something it reads as different from the pattern that's expected. Same for change, same for transitions. The error detection mechanism fires. And we're going to talk a little bit later about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, we struggle to embrace change. I mentioned that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching, each have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. I want to discuss in this session what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients: regulating states of mind. Never more important than at a time of change and transition. So first, let's talk about understanding states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. A state of mind is like the software program in that it's a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element in our mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with a particular focus on what state works best for what purpose. So here's an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. It's a primitive but a vivid illustration. You take a rat, put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again once it's taught. Now, if you, before teaching the rat to get to the cheese, inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, then you teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It has, in a part of its brain, the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. Re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. Don't inject the amphetamine, the rat can literally die of starvation in that maze, not being able to access the information. This is state-specific learning and state-dependent memory. Think about a simple example. You are working about something, you're trying to think of somebody, you got their name just on the tip of your tongue, or got that piece of information just on the tip of your tongue, can't quite grasp it. And then you kind of forget it, let it go, and then go about your business. And later, when you're in a different, usually more relaxed state, boom, it comes to you. So this is really an example, in the rat example, of how extreme stress, like post-traumatic stress disorder, when an entire event may not be remembered in the usual way. Now, a more common example is, as I said, when we try to remember somebody's name and can't. A state of mind is a mind-body state like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and respond. So each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. So it's really important to become aware, for example, of what state we want to enter for a creative purpose, what state we want to enter for conceptual planning, for attention and concentration of what works best were everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. And this is not the subject that I'm going to cover, but this is where mindfulness and meditation can be hugely significant, to become aware of thoughts, aware of how we think, by becoming aware and observant, beginning simply with breathing. Now, here's a mentor coaching application. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand that client's subjective experience as well as the story communicated by the client. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal linguistic abilities of the left brain mature. So most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right brain to right brain communication of emotional states of both coach and client. And this works just as well in telephone sessions as it does in face-to-face sessions. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. Together, then, we can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either of us may go alone. So what we must allow is this right brain engagement with a client to take in this emotional communication, to hold unexplained experiences and feelings and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. And through the process of change and transition, a lot will be unexplained and without closure for a while. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and the neuroscience of mentor coaching. So let's look now at how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our states of mind. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. The particular state of mind, the software program you choose, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. Now, there are two primary ways to regulate your state of mind: focus and physiology. Physiology is how you use your body to change your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. Simple examples are relaxation, deep breathing, meditation. And focus is what and how you focus on. Now, from quantum physics in the brain, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. And think about how that works from, like, an infant who's upset and you jangle car keys and that sudden change of focus changes the state instantly. How, when you're working with a client, you interrupt and ask a question, and suddenly it shifts their focus to the question that you ask. So your power is what you focus on. Now, the questions we ask regularly, consistently, determine our focus. A couple of questions we're always asking. What does this mean? What should I do? Now, if you have an habitual feeling you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and questions from a state of mind. Why does this always happen to me? Why am I overweight? So the quality of your life can come down to the quality of questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. Now, remember, we're always asking questions from the moment we wake up, though we may not be aware of them. If you immediately begin asking, what can go wrong today? Or, can I really do this? You have instantly established a state of mind of doubt or uncertainty, or booted up an old state that's related to some previous situation that is one of worry, of rumination. So, ask a better question. What will I create today that will be more powerful than I ever dreamed of? And have fun doing it. Now, your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. Ask questions habitually that empower you. Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your power of focus. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, well, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask people if they wanted a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen to how Steve Jobs convinced former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO at that time of Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or you want to change the world? So here's an exercise I'm going to suggest to you. I've suggested it to two or three clients who have situations where they have been in a repetitive environment where they're worried about something. I became familiar with this with someone who was CEO of a company where a tragedy happened to the company, and it was preoccupying that person and the executive suite and all the way down to everyone in the company as we looked at different measures of that. And immediately, this is what I recommend, emphasizing as I just did to you. As soon as we wake up, we're asking ourselves questions. So, and he recognized that the questions he was asking was, what can go wrong today? What's going to happen? Is this going to result in, you know, somebody shutting down my company? Is this going to result in that? You know, all the things that put him in an act. So I recommended that before he go to sleep, sometime at the end of the day, to write down three questions that were empowering questions that would immediately put him in a positive state of mind, and to put them at his bedside as soon as he turned on his lamp in the morning, as soon as he woke up, before his feet ever hit the floor, to look at those questions and answer them. And he found that by doing that, it put him in a very positive and powerful state of mind that initiated the day and lasted several hours through the day. And within a week and a half, there had been a turnaround in the executive suite, and it trickled down to managers at his company in the various ways we looked at that and using 360. So this just changes the focus to consistently engineer questions that will empower you. I just worked with someone today who, we both in various levels work with pro athletes. And what he was aware of was that when he began at my recommendation to do 5 minutes of meditation each morning, it helped him focus, it helped him move into a state that he then decided to repeat that for the first few weeks. He repeated it every couple of hours and did a 5-minute meditation throughout the day until that became more automatic and more regulated. Now, let's look at mantras and self-regulation. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage. That was lowest in their division nationwide. So during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot, a three-part cue, focus, and physiology. The cue that he suggested was to take two dribbles, The focus, he suggested, was a phrase that would put them in a relaxed and powerful position. He suggests relaxed and powerful, but emphasized that they create their own phrase. And at the same time they did the cue to dribble twice and to say the phrase to themselves, he suggested that they take one deep breath for relaxation in and breathe out any tension. And in addition to that, after they shot, if they made both shots, they got a breather. If they didn't, they took a lap, which simulated away in home games, you know, a natural experiment. Think about natural controlled experiments in the NBA. There are 84 games, 42 are at home, 42 are away. Teams lose almost twice as many away as they do at home, win almost twice as many at home as they do away. Think about the energy of the crowd and the energy that happens. Now, in 2 years, his team was ranked number one in their division nationwide. So again, three parts to a mantra. A cue, two dribbles, or a personal gesture. It can be something as simple as putting your index finger and your thumb together on one hand before you give a keynote, which is what I do. A phrase like relaxed and powerful. A deep breath to breathe in relaxation, to breathe out tension. Now, think of the focus, the phrase, to usher in exactly the state that you want. Relaxed and powerful may be good for a keynote, but it's not what you want when you want to go to sleep. You want to go relaxed to sleep. When you want to do an optimum performance, like in athletics, you want to enter that state and maintain that state of mind. One pro athlete, because football is a game of segments, it's not a flow like basketball. He's an all-pro, three times wide receiver, and his phrase each time, after each play, was reset. Because he knew he had to reset after every play, because the most common disruption is being on tilt. If you do something, if you mess up, you feel bad. If you do something spectacular, you're on tilt, and you feel great, and you may mess up. So you want to be sure the current state doesn't spill into the next task. So it was reset after every play. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. So mantras can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in high-pressure situations. Now, in terms of neural conditioning, what we associate to a stimulus is what determines our behavior. So, in other words, to change your behavior, change your neural association. So thinking positively is not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to what you already established in your brain and the neural networks and connections. It would be the same effect as trying to change a software program by booting up and talking positively to your computer. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe it or know it's there. It's linked. Winston tastes good. What's your association? For 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been 30 years since you've heard that jingle. So what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior when you change the meaning. You can reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, which is simply neuroassociative conditioning, is a process, not an event. You can't work out one time and be healthy for life. Now, a neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. This creates a link. Anchors happen when you're in a highly emotional state. So, let's look at this in a somewhat different way. There are two forces behind all behavior. And these are brain-based forces. The need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. So to understand these two motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis and to avoid triggering the error detection mechanism. Trying to create more success by creating more pain usually does not work. In any moment, for example, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of overweight. The pleasure of cheesecake is more enjoyable than the pain of the later abstract notion of being overweight or out of shape. Overweight is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as immediate pleasure. Spending money in this moment is a greater pleasure, or the anticipation of spending money is a greater pleasure. It immediately creates the release of dopamine, the anticipatory pleasure, by the pleasure center. Then the later gain of money by avoiding debt or by saving for the future. Saving for the future is an abstract notion. It's a future notion. No part of the brain lights up. This is why it's a challenge to strategically plan so that you do and make decisions what's in your best interest. So to change your behavior, one way, one simple way is you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. So the need to avoid pain is greater usually than the need for pleasure. This drives much of human behavior. So to influence somebody, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and what they link pleasure to. So here's the key. If you have a plan, a reasonable plan to do something, and you're not doing what you want or need to do, At some level, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. So think about this with your next client. The client has a plan. That's always the first question. Do you have a plan? Do you know what the next step is? Have you shrunk the change, and do you have a strategy for the next step? If you have a plan and you get to the cusp of that plan and you decide not to do it. Now, listening to the internal conversation may be interesting. How did that person have an internal conversation to decide no? Did you decide to bargain with yourself and say, well, I'm going to do it next Tuesday? Did you decide to oppose your own authority and say, well, the hell with it, I'm going to do what I want to do? Or did you get scattered and not know or remember exactly what the next step was? But if you stop, if you have a plan and stop from doing it, then there is something that you're linking pain about doing it. For example, if you have a surface story, a conscious, logical, intellectual story of, I want to generate more money and create wealth. Now, if there's a shadow story that has to do with pain, even though it's not conscious, may not make sense. All this effort it would take, and I think I'm just as comfortable with where I am. The pain of leaving a comfort zone, of going into the uncertain, the uncharted, being possibly embarrassed by failing. Or I have to take advantage of people, and that's not like me. Or people are going to judge me, and I'll be ostracized. Or it'll be lonely at the top, all alone. So if you're sabotaging success in any area of your life, think about it not as sabotage, because that implies willful negative intent. Just simply look at the approach, wanting pleasure and avoidance or fear of pain. Because somebody who sabotages their success, it won't be helpful to talk about it at that level, because that sounds pejorative to start with. They would have to agree with your supposition that they're actively sabotaging their success. Now, that may be the result, but it's not the intent, so we have to look at the intent. What is it they intend to do so that we can create a better strategy for the intent, so that we can help them look at these two coaching questions? What would be the greater pain if you don't do it? And what would be the greater pleasure if you do it? Now, we're defined by the stories we tell ourselves. Is your story empowering you or causing you to fall short? Is your story limiting any area of your life? Which one is true? The one you pick will be the one you live and come to believe. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe or can't quite inhabit. The story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. For many people, the most limiting story is the story about why we can't have what we want. Now, think about this. What's the biggest addiction that we have? The thing almost impossible to give up or abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and actually allows us to escape our own fear. Our biggest addiction is our problems. Now, for any situation, there are three components: state, story, and strategy. State management is the most important aspect, to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome. State always comes first because state determines the meaning that we attach. The meaning we attach determines our behavior. Story is the organizer of what we do, the theme and storylines of what we pursue. For Martin Luther King, his story was, "I have a dream." Strategy is to move beliefs to behavior for successful performance. Most people start with strategy, but strategy is an evolved part of the process. Reevaluation of your approach, your state of mind, is a key element. In neuroconditioning, state comes first, then behavior. Now, a practical application here. When you're working with a client and they begin by talking about this has been an overwhelming experience. This has been so confusing. I don't know what's next. The first step, not entering strategy immediately about what to do, the first step is to resonate with their emotional state, with their experience, to empathically resonate and to connect with that. You know, I hear how overwhelming this has seemed to you, so that you've immediately established common ground, so that you then can move to the next step of collaborating about what that strategy and what that story will be. So now let's look at bringing this together. How do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three key principles in neuroconditioning to create change and make it last. One. This is all in your outline. Identify what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change something. You must change it now that you can change it. Must, can, will, change it. And to feel that not changing would ultimately be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. And comfortable is not a prerequisite. Nobody is going to begin doing anything important that feels comfortable. Believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. Change can be linked with pleasure. So here are some questions to ask for this first step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What is the pain associated to a current choice that's now adaptive? And what will the pleasure be with changing? Two. Interrupt the existing pattern. A pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. You just can't add something on, add a piece of behavior, and expect it's going to do any neural rewiring, because you have to disrupt the pattern that's there, then create a new one. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. So here are a couple of questions for this step. What are the cues or the triggers for this automatic state change and behavior pattern? Think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it, or specifically to use the cue as a recognition to get present and centered, and then look at what your ideal behavior is. As a cue, in other words, to do your mantra. 3, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves into the new story. So here are a couple of questions for this step, step 3. What is the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you want to bring about? And think of all the things you gain and all the pleasure you'll have with the change. And remember, that's why we do whatever we do, because we imagine how it's going to make us feel to do it. That's our primary motivation to really do something. We imagine how we're going to feel when we do it. It's also a primary way that we avoid something. We are afraid of how it's going to make us feel, so we'll avoid something. And that's the fear and the pleasure applied in this way. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. I know you've heard of this, about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. So he set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. What he found was that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference that created their survival. 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death, the pain that they were experiencing, the inevitable death. The people who survived developed a different focus, a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering, to change the framework, rather than accepting their fate and wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so they could tell their story to their children to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of the suffering. It was state changing. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped pull them through the toughest of times. So, then let's apply this in conclusion, mindset mapping for growth. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. Our mindset frames the ongoing account of how we interpret, process, and what we do. Mindsets, or state of minds, are powerful beliefs of the stories we have about ourselves or whatever mindset we boot up. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. So, in other words, a human brain operates like a Google map. There's a particular cue or stimulus, and it boots up a particular map or mindset to handle this situation. This explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations and how we have different states of mind or mindsets. So what we need to do then is to stay in charge of this, to regulate our states of mind, and to create a cohesive story so that all of these mindsets fit together and have a strategy, a purpose, and a goal. A mindset is its own world, its own software program, complete and internally consistent. So we need to do the work of fitting it into our story. And remember, the mindset comes first. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach to any cue or stimulus. The meaning determines your behavior. So to change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. Regulate the state of mind. So here's a simple example of this in application. Fixed versus growth mindset. A growth mindset is what we coach toward, based on a belief in change. And Howard Gardner, in his book Extraordinary Minds, concluded that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. In other words, the ability to reflect on their experience and on their mind. The growth mindset of learning is based on a belief that basic qualities are cultivated, developed, and evolved throughout life. The fundamental assumption is that everyone can change and grow through experience and application, that you can even change how intelligent you are. Now, by contrast, a fixed mindset, this is what we coach away from and help someone address, those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed. A consuming goal may be to prove themselves in a classroom, in a career, in a relationship. The fixed mindset requires proving yourself again and again. Each situation calls for a confirmation of intelligence or personality or character. The repeated questions are, will I succeed or will I fail? Will I look dumb or smart? Will I be rejected or accepted? Will I be a loser or a winner? Yet with a fixed mindset, no amount of confirmation can dislodge the hypothesis of mediocrity or the need for proof. So a fixed mindset makes you preoccupied with how you'll be judged versus a growth mindset focusing on improvement. So a fixed mindset shares some of these characteristics. Intelligence, and each of these are coachable moments in my view. Intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving that you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair your self-esteem can include assigning blame or making excuses. So, a growth mindset can be prompted by, what can we learn from this? How can you improve? Now, here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the three-year period of study. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test score equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in a three-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make someone age physically more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. It reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years. So they lived into the belief that they had or died into it. So to help clients change behavior, minds, and brains, begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neural networks like natural talents, behaviors, and patterns to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. So that means let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. And encourage the clients to review their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. So I'm going to kind of usurp our discussion period because I want to do a summary here of some principles of successful mentor coaching. This is a good place to do it because it'll be something we can refer to in the next two seminars and kind of a summary of the application of what we've done so far. So I hope you don't mind doing this. So here's some some principles of successful changes in mentor coaching. So we focus on solutions rather than understanding why, on looking at options co-created rather than usually giving advice or dictates. Since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to change this wiring. The first requirement is recognizing and claiming ownership of the story, followed by understanding, assessing, and changing. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing task is to teach people how to learn. So let's review just these bullets of important elements to mentor, coach, successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits. Regulate a state of mind to manage emotions and promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur when there is balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. That occurs when someone is grounded and centered, when they have access to all the information in all their states of mind. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. And people can usually tell when you do something like attempt to persuade versus prompting insight. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Facilitate new behaviors and guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy to the new ideas. And remember again, the power is in the focus, and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind, the brain. Remember what we talked about, and I reiterated, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd all eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot saved up for the future, we'd work out every day, a lot of librarians would be billionaires. And finally, conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This helps create an internal model that incorporates these new experiences as part of an evolving identity. This is powerful because what we do consistent with our identity. If we have a new piece of behavior that we don't incorporate a change and a transition to the model that we use, how we see ourselves, we'll revert back to the old behavior. So we want to be sure that with that behavior change and transition, that we help someone incorporate that as part of an evolving model of who someone is. So we're out of time. I appreciate your attention and energy. If you have questions, either jot them down or send them to me by email, and we'll pick up right here next time with a discussion. And I promise a discussion at the beginning next time. Thanks very much. I hope this was helpful and stimulating for you.